Welcome. We're honored to have you listen and participate in these dialogues produced by the Cora Dubrowtsov Foundation. To learn more about the foundation and about how you can help us in our mission of unearthing untold stories of moral energy, please visit us at virtuesofpeace.com. There you can access show archives, show resources, visit our Etsy shop, and support us with a donation. virtuesofpeace.com.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and I'm joined by Randy Olson, Riley Olson, no, they are not related, and our special guest, Hedvig Kovac, and who's joining us from London. Welcome, Hedvig.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yes, we're happy to have you too, and happy to have you, Randy and Riley, as well.
It's good to be here.
Yes, happy to join again after a long time.
Yeah. So first of all, before I get into what the show is about, so you, the listeners, know, all of us about 3 months ago were in London at the opening of the exhibit that Hedvig created at the Florence Nightingale Museum. So just all of us were there. It was very intense, and we're going to be talking about Hedvig's research and her learning journey. But the title of this show is Encountering Nurse Catherine Pine and the Militant Suffragette Movement. And that those words right there, we can unpack that without even getting into the description. But let me just read the description here. So it was on International Women's Day when the Florence Nightingale Museum in London launched a special exhibit on Nurse Catherine Pine. And this exhibit is still running, and it runs until October 4th, 2026. As I said, Hedvig created this exhibit, and she will be a graduate of Westminster University's master's program in museums, galleries, and contemporary culture. And as part of that degree, she was an intern at the Florence Nightingale Museum. It was Hedvig who researched and created what's called the In Focus exhibit on Nurse Catherine Pine. And we're going to be talking with Hedvig about her learning journey into what's called the militant suffrage movement. And behind the scenes, if you will, is this decision that we've talked about in another show. And that show is the show of April 21st, 2024. And this decision of Nurse Catherine Pine to bequeath, leave in her will, her last will and testament, her, quote, suffragette medal. And that's a whole nother show. So if you want that background, that's April 21st, 2024 show. You can access that on our show resources page, virtuesofpeace.com. So, okay, Hedvig, so you're about to graduate in August, is that right?
Early September, but okay, yeah, essentially.
Okay, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
On coming to that amazing milestone. And so this is a master's degree that you're pursuing, correct?
Yes, exactly. So this is a master's. It was a 2-year-long course. Essentially, the second year is just this placement. That's an extended placement. Mine was, I believe, it was in the span of 7 or 8 months. And then the rest is really just the dissertation work.
Mm. Yeah. And so you're working on that now?
Yes. So it's thankfully it's in a very progressed state, but I still need to, do some additional research and finalize things. But yes, that's the only thing I'm working on now. So it kind of feels like in a way as if I'm not even on the course anymore because there's no lectures or anything like that happening. So it's this in-between period now.
And you have to be proactive in writing and editing and so forth.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. Which I quite love doing. It's just difficult when you start, but I can't quite stop when I get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, we all know. And so This is a degree in museums, galleries, and contemporary culture. And can you say a bit about your background? Because you're not from England, correct?
Yes. So I was born and raised in Hungary, and I moved abroad to England when I was 18 for university for my BA course. My family still lives in Hungary, but I was quite set on settling down in the UK. Initially, my BA was in film and television, which is, I guess, a bit of a bigger jump from museums, but the way I'm looking at it, it is still culture and arts. So I worked in film for a bit after I finished that in the art department, which was quite interesting, but eventually I realized that as much as I'm fascinated by it, it's not the job I want to do long term. So that's when I did a career switch, I would say, but I wouldn't say that I already had a full-fledged career, but regularly, yeah.
I'm curious, like, how that moment where you pivoted into thinking about museums, like, where were you at? Like, how did you get to that place? Because that's a big shift.
It was difficult and easy at the same time, because I've had this very deep interest in museums and archives and galleries since forever. So that was something I've always sought out, I guess, in a hobby level. And of course, living in London, it's just, it's everywhere. So I was very immersed in it. But I guess I was working as a freelancer in film for about maybe 2 years when I got to the point of realizing that this is something that I don't see myself doing for the following decades, I guess. So in retrospect, it was it shouldn't have been as difficult of a choice, because at the time I felt like, well, I've gone down so far already, I don't know how to turn around now. Well, I was maybe 25 years old, so I wasn't that far down. But yeah, once I did make the decision to restudy and do my master's, and before that I was already volunteering with heritage organizations and other museums as well. So it was gradually building up to it, but when I did make the jump into doing my master's, it all kind of just fell into place, and you know, it just felt right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I'm always just trying to, like, understand how people go from one big transition to another.
Yes.
It's always an amazing story, so thank you.
No, of course.
Did you do your undergrad at Westminster?
No, my undergrad was at University of the Arts, London.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to just say, like, you mentioned you were 25 and you thought, oh, I've already gone so far this way, it's hard to switch. And that just made me laugh, because I'm sure everyone else here can remember too. Like, when you're 25, it feels like, oh my gosh, I've already done so much, I'm stuck here. Like,
yes.
I can't change anything. So, like, being 25 and then being able to take that jump was, like, brave. And then now, looking back, are you like, well, of course I could make this.
Yes. It sounds so silly, especially even at the time. You know, I had family members who've done similar things. I've met countless people who have done similar things. And you know, that there's people in their 40s who do this successfully. Of course you can do it at 25, but in the moment it's just terrifying to leave something that was, you know, going somewhere.
Well, yeah, so I guess the interesting next transition for me is about, like, prior to the exhibit and prior to being involved with the Florence Nightingale Museum at all, what was your engagement looking like with the women's suffrage story? Was it something you had connected with before all this? What does that all look like?
I had a very minimal connection to the suffrage movement, unfortunately. It was only after moving to the UK that I became more acutely aware of it. Of course, we, you know, in my earlier education, we studied about it, but I think it's because it wasn't something that happened in our country. I think the educational system didn't focus on it too much. But when I came in the UK, it was a very celebrated part of history. So that's where I became more engaged with it. But when I started working on the Nurse Pine project, I realized very quickly that, oh, I barely knew anything about it. It's just, it has so many layers and it's really fascinating.
So yeah, you created this exhibit as an intern, which you said was part of like the second year, there's this placement.
Yes.
And as I understand it, you had been to the museum before you were an intern.
Yes.
So can you talk about that move from student to intern? You wanted to go to the Florence Nightingale Museum. Can you just talk about that?
Yes, of course. So, well, first of all, let me not take too much credit. So Hannah, the amazing curator at the museum, I mean, she was in charge of everything. I did do the research, but it's really her who did, you know, everything make fall into place. But yeah, I've been to the Florence Nightingale Museum before that, but it was in pre-COVID times, so it was quite a long time ago, but I really enjoyed it. But when I was looking for places to do my internship at, I really just wanted it to be a museum that's a smaller, independent museum, you know, where I could get as much out of it as possible. Because other than the fact that, you know, larger institutions, the getting in there for work experience is a very convoluted process, if you can even do it. But I think it's just so much more immersive and so much more informative when you're in a smaller museum and, you know, you can have a direct access to see everything. So, yeah, and I knew that the Florence Nightingale Museum was of a similar size, so when I reached out to them, I was very, very happy that they got back to me and they were interested in talking about it.
And so, why did you visit it in the first place before COVID?
Back then, I believe it was when I was actually not even living in the UK. So I was here as a tourist, and it was, you know, one of those museums that we just wanted to see, because Florence Nightingale, again, you know, I knew of her from history, but it was one of those things that, again, it wasn't as heavily featured in my education as I know it is for kids growing up in the UK. So I had more of a knowledge of Florence Nightingale from, you know, pop culture. Like, she was just someone that cropped up so much, and that's where majority of my information was of her. So I was very interested in finding out beyond that, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So you've moved in like what I wanted to do as a student in like unbelievably lockstep fashion to like you lived out the ideal for me, and so I'm just like blown away like walking through it.
That's the thing, I just got extremely fortunate, and that is the takeaway I come to whenever I'm talking to anyone with, you know, how things are going for me with my studies and such, is that obviously I put in the effort. I was retraining. I knew I wanted to do an internship because one of my close friends, who she works in fashion actually, but she went to Westminster and she's doing really well. And she also went this route of doing an extended placement, and she built up her network. So it's not all coming from me. I'm building up people around me that I see, if that makes sense. And then, you know, just luck also factors a lot.
I mean, so you were volunteering at museums, like, so these are places that are very important to you just as a person. I'm curious,
yes.
like as a, is there a way of looking at it for you that's sacred? Because for me, when I think of libraries and museums, mm-hmm. there's something about the way that they hold the past and they bring it to the present that is all the way at the root level, like connection. And I'm curious, like, it sounds like that's going on for you too. Could you speak to that at all?
Yes, absolutely. I did have that feeling before this internship as well, but I just didn't understand, I guess, the level of just information and history that's held in the museums. And again, the Florence Nightingale Museum is comparatively a small museum, but when I was doing another bigger project at the museum for me, which was going through the unaccessioned objects, and you know, there was so many nurses' personal letters and such who trained at the Nightingale Training School, and obviously I have to read it so I know what's in it, and it's just, you get so engrossed in these people's lives, and it's just it's just almost unimaginable to think how many stories are in these collections, and most of them unfortunately don't even see the light of day as far as the public is concerned.
So like you mentioning all of the objects you were going through, were there like any particular collections of objects that like really spoke to you, or something that made you dive down like a rabbit hole, so to speak?
There was one that I quite a few, but we had a collection, or like a large group of objects belonging to Leslie Graham, who was the first male nurse at the Nightingale Training School. And it was just incredible for so many reasons. First of all, he donated all of his relevant objects to the museum himself, but it was so meticulously categorized by himself when he gave it over to the museum that it was very much like pine in the way that he knew how important this is, and he wanted it to be remembered for future generations. And he, you know, you're reading his letters and you're going through his career progression as well, and it's very odd because you get connected to them without, you know, ever knowing this person in real life. So because there was such a comprehensive collection of Leslie Graham's things that I've gone through, his story, I think, really connected with.
So are those objects then unaccessioned?
They are accessioned now. So I believe we already had a large chunk of it accessioned at the museum. And for some reason, there was a part of it that I guess people didn't get to it. And then, you know, there's so much to do with the collections that I guess it was forgotten. And now it's accessioned, though.
Okay, very good. And the dates of Leslie Graham, because I've never heard of him.
Honestly, I don't recall. It's 60s, 70s-ish,
okay.
I think.
Right. Like, okay.
Yes.
1960s. Okay, amazing. So, yeah, I mean, I'm interested because, as you said, like Pine, he's very intentional and aware of the educational power.
Yes.
Of his. So there's objects and letters?
Yes, there's objects and letters. We have his scissors to cut bandages. We have, I believe we have his badge. I might be wrong on that, but we have loads of letters and correspondences, yeah.
We've said, you know, your last day at the museum was May 8th, is that right? Your last
day? Yes. Okay. Yes, that's correct.
And you have since then been working on your papers and editing. And are you doing anything else besides that, or is that like the bulk of your existence now?
Well, that was the bulk of my existence. up until now, I am going to start a new job, however, tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
Yes, so you always reach out to me in times of big changes happening. But yeah, so that is why I was also so intent on getting all the assessments out of the way, because I did want to get a job ideally before I properly graduated, because otherwise, essentially, I'm just working on the dissertation and I can take a job on top of that.
So you left on May 8th and now you're working on your dissertation. Is your dissertation related to your time at the museum or Catherine Pine, or is it something different?
Yes, so it's something completely different, which I feel like is always a bit of a disappointing answer to give, because rightfully so, people think that it would be something connected to Pine, and that would be a lot easier as well. So, hey, maybe I made a mistake, but I'm really passionate about my research topic for my dissertation, which is about cemeteries in London that operate as cultural and community.
That's really cool, actually. I'm not
Thank
disappointed
you.
By that answer at all.
Yeah. Okay, and I'm glad to hear.
It does relate quite a bit, anyway, to the medal, as we'll get into it, because it was left in her will, and like,
so I guess it does
leftover object as a cultural piece, and then you're looking at cemeteries as, you know, it's connected.
It is connected, I guess. Yeah, it's respecting, you know, the wishes of the dead, and it's a whole conversation about what is appropriate to do in a cemetery and what is not. So, yeah, I guess it does connect.
So one of the things I'd be really interested to hear next is kind of how the project got started, like how it got brought to you, and how the medal like just began being part of this project, because I know it just like drops in, like this particular item is very heavy, it just drops and swallows like the, you know, the space around it intellectually for a while, because it's so cool, like it has a gravity to it. I'm curious, like, how did this like start for you, this particular object and this particular story?
Yes, so I was very lucky. It was actually before my just before I started my placement that Hannah and Laura from the museum let me know that this Catherine Pine exhibition that I didn't even know about beforehand is actually going to go ahead, because when we were still talking prior to finalizing things, they told me that they would be very happy for me to kind of undertake a bigger project, which I was very excited about, but I didn't know what it was going to be about. So it was just before the placement that I got I guess a summary document of Catherine Pine and the medal, and it was just so immediately engrossing. It's just so fascinating. And of course, I didn't know about Pine before, so it was all just so much information. And the Nurse Pine Medal website was just an incredible starting point, because I know, Hope, you say that it's I guess it's a map, it's a storytelling device, the medal itself, and it's really true, because it was really the starting point of the whole research process for me to have these dates to refer to and these names to look into.
I guess so you have these like dates you can start with, and like at what point do you start to like become more passionate about her? Because I know like when I saw you speaking about your research, like there's something that like it really ignited in you, I could see, you know. So like what, like I don't know, I guess at what point in starting this research were you like, whoa, like this is an awesome woman?
Honestly, immediately when I just read that initial document, and when I started researching with Hope's website, I was just immediately engrossed. And I guess a part of it is this incredibly unfortunate and just unjust fact that she's basically kind of forgotten by history. which I was thinking about it today, that maybe that's what she wanted it to be apart from the medal, because, you know, she never wrote a book, as far as I know, or never intended to, and she really, I think, dropped out of public view after she separated from Pankhurst. So apart from the medal, maybe she didn't want to be focused on like the way the Pankhursts are, but yeah, that is why, because she's just so incredible. She was an entrepreneur basically with her nursing home with Gertrude Townend. It's just in that time to open that as two women, and then they spent so much time in campaigning for the vote as well, and you can see it in the archive of the British Journal for Nursing, I believe it was, that they continuously appeared, both of them, for both how progressive their nursing home was at the time, and there was an article about a new working hours that they were trialing. I believe it was 8 hours or just something that's so much less than even the standard is now, and how they were willing to pay for more nurses to work so they can provide better, you know, more well-rested nurses to their patients. And which is, even today, this is revolutionary, to be honest. And on top of that, they were leading the nursing contingencies of the suffragette marches, and it's just so much on their plate. They were doing, both of them were doing so much, and it's just, I think it's just incredible.
I find that interesting, you saying that she maybe didn't really want to be focused on, and connecting that back to this medal being such a wonderful, like, storytelling device. All of the dates, as you find out in your research, they're all related to the Pankhursts. And
yeah,
care of-
I do, when I was doing my research, I, after, you know, I've exhausted what can be found via the medal online, I immediately jumped to the autobiographies of the Pankhursts. And it was just really shocking that Pine was barely ever mentioned in them, which I, and she was so integral to their life of that time. So I still don't quite know why that was. I do find that very odd.
So I want to move over to talking about the exhibit a little bit. I had a couple interesting thoughts about it. I want to see what you think. So first, just to recap, like, the exhibit consists of 7 panels tracing Pine's life, activism, nursing work, and it's like there's a mystery surrounding her suffragette medal. And there's a lot of information packaged in this exhibit, but you had to, like, distill it down to these 7 panels. And I'm sure that there was a lot that had to get cut, because there's a storytelling and narrative, like, requirement to the display. So I'm curious, like, as part of building it, when, like, what went into selecting how the panels were going to get, like, organized? I'm curious, like, how you did that.
Yes. Actually, that was one of the, for me, I think it was one of the most informative parts of my internship, because I was, you know, just being in university, I was very used to how to put information into, like, an academic paper, but I didn't know how to translate that onto an exhibition. Obviously, it's very different the way you present things. So I was quite lost with that, and it was really both Hannah and Laura from the museum that really guided me, and they wrote, they rewrote my, like, this, I guess, master document I had into how it should be presented in the exhibition panels, and so that was just incredible from them. But when we were initially talking about how to divide up this whole story into these 7 panels, because the space that we, or they do these in focus exhibitions, is the same space, so it's the 7 panels are the standard. It was quite tricky. At the beginning of the research process, it was I was actually quite nervous on how I'm going to find enough information to fill the panels. And then, of course, by the end of it, we had to just cut out so much, which is obviously the issue you want to have. But it was very interesting because most of the documented years of Pine is when she was involved with the Pankhurst. So she the Pankhursts were really weaved in throughout whole of the narrative, and it was actually Laura, the director, who said that if a person is coming to this exhibit, they are mostly drawn in by the suffragette aspect of it. Like, they are interested to see who this nurse was that was so close to Emmeline Pankhurst, and that is what probably the average visitor would like to see. So, you know, we need to make this information readily accessible to them. So it was her suggestion to have two panels that specifically focus on the relationship between Pine and Pankhurst. One of them was just, you know, about how their friendship started, and then the other one was the later years in the US and Canada. But of course, Pankhurst does crop up obviously all across, but you know, the bulk of their story is in those two panels.
Yeah, I remember being there and knowing that like each one of the panels had like this completeness to it that I am just still experiencing. It's been 3 months and it's still hitting me, so I just wanted to say thank you for a job well done on that in particular.
Thank you. Well, I mean, again, I don't want to take too much credit because it was, like I said, this was the most, for me, this was the most formative part, I think, of as far as, you know, learning how to create exhibits, how to format exhibits was really this part, because it's just incredibly difficult to divide up her life and her narrative. That's everything is interconnected, but try to separate it enough that it makes sense is quite a challenge.
So can you speak to how, like, the metal being part of the exhibit changed the way you needed to organize and, like, structure that story? And that, because it seems like the metal becomes its own storytelling device.
Yes.
So just how did those two interact?
Yes, absolutely. So we had the metal... I'm sure you remember, but for the listeners who weren't there, in this display case in the middle, and we had these panels describing briefly what happened with each corresponding date. So I think that was a decision made so I guess it was more clear for the audience, because if it's right next to the medal, you can read what happened and you can refer back to it when you're reading about the relationship between Pine and Pankhurst. So it wasn't, when we were talking about their relationship, it wasn't too much of like, you know, this and happened, but you could go into more of,
yeah.
I don't want to say emotional aspect, but you know, more of a narrative, I guess.
Yeah, because it's like all the list is here, so now we can explain it on the panel.
Exactly. It's like, this is what happened when, and this is how it unfolded and made things different.
So, okay, I guess just to round that off, I know that the selection process is one of the challenges, but was there any other, like, overall hardest part of the research around this particular project that stands out?
Yes, I think the hardest part was really finding out more about Pine's early years and before she went into nursing, really, because we had a lot of data available with she was studying and working at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. So I went into their archives to, you know, look at relevant objects, and we could find quite, I think, a decent amount of information about her as a training nurse, but everything before that is quite undocumented because she was living at home in Kent with her parents. So it was mostly, obviously, we are drawing a lot on Elizabeth Crawford's book about the suffragettes. So she has really done the legwork for us to build upon. But she was referencing these dates that I could then follow up in the census records and build upon a bit with, you know, baptism registers. And then you can find out a bit more about her, that the father was, for example, a corn merchant and, you know, just more about their living situations when she was still at home. But that was the most difficult, and I do believe it's quite a short section in the exhibit as well, because there's just only so much we could extract from that.
So given, you know, just in following this thread of things that are, like, not part of the official, like, archival record, they don't make it into the books, we know Nurse Pine was acting as a caregiver, but there's also this political activism that shows up towards the end. Maybe there's more in the beginning that we don't know about. But I'm curious, like, does the combination of nursing and activism, does that surprise you? Does that, like, because when I first discovered these things coming together, I didn't really connect hunger strikes and political activism until this story. This is what brought them together. It's like, oh, this was a tool. And, did you have a similar experience there? What did that look like?
Yes, I was, I guess the aspect of her being a nurse and then being so involved with political activism, I guess about the rights for women, I guess it wasn't that surprising. What was more surprising is how involved she was, you know, because it's easy to say, yes, of course, I support, yes, we should get the vote, and then just not really do much about it. But like I said, in the British Journal of Nursing, you can see that she was leading these marches. She was so actively participating in them, and in the suffragette journals and newspapers, you can see that both her and Gertrude Townend funded and donated more significant amount of money to the movement. So it was, I guess, an interesting thing about Pine is, even though she was so closely aligned with the Pankhurst, she, as far as we know, she never did any illegal means of protesting. But even though she never stepped over that line, but she was so prominent in it, which I was, again, surprised. From that standpoint of, she was running this nursing home with Townend, and they just had so much on their plate, and she still had the time to be so deeply involved, regardless of the Pankhurst, but just to show up to the marches is, I think, and lead them, the nurses, is just very, very impressive.
It's interesting because, as you say, like, she did not directly participate in any criminal action, but the authorities had a file on her for aiding and abetting. So she was, you know, indirectly, if you will, you know, supporting a criminal enterprise.
I guess it's true. She was, that is not correct to say actually that she wasn't doing anything illegally, because she was helping Pankhurst evade police capture. I guess she was never caught and imprisoned for anything.
They were looking at her.
But,
you know, they were looking at a lot of people, and they were, the Home Office was looking at, you know, and they had a trial, but they were looking at the wider network and a conspiracy. I think it was the Malicious Destruction of Property Act. I think that was the specific law that they were focused on. But I also want to ask, because as Randy, you know, pointed, like, you guys are talking about all of the stuff that didn't make it in to the exhibit. And given all, and, you know, you you're really learning about the suffrage movement in a very deep way with this story. And is there a story that stays with you? Like, is it the Cat and Mouse Act? Is it the hunger strikes? Is it her nursing home or entrepreneurial skill that you mentioned? Is there something that sticks out for you out of all of the landscape of story that you uncovered?
I would say, apart from just everything to do with pine, that something that or someone that I came across while researching pine that really stuck with me is Ethel Smith. Ethel Smith was a pioneering musician, again, pioneer for the queer community, especially in that era. And she was, again, a suffragette too. And actually, it was Ethel Smith's book called Female Pipings in Eden that was, again, just an incredible resource on pine, especially because in that book, Smith included a lot of her personal correspondence with Pankhurst. And then I could see what I guess I was hoping to see in the Pankhurst biographies, but they were not there. Is in the letters, Pankhurst was referencing pine a lot, talking about how important pine was to her. That was very just incredible, and it was a great resource. But apart from that, Ethel Smith herself is just an incredible person. And reading that book, I'm sad to say I still haven't finished the book, the complete book, because it's not just all about the Pankhurst. That's just a part of it. Apart from being an amazing composer, her writing is incredible. She is extremely talented. She like it's a page turner, really. She's so funny. And just to think of her as just being a pioneer and a leader in so many things is, I think, compared to how fascinating she is, I don't think she's well known enough. So Ethel Smith,
yeah.
I would say she's, yeah.
And I think there's a picture of her. And
yes.
That's such a great picture.
I love that picture. Yeah, it's when I think they wanted to arrest Pankhurst, and she was sitting on Ethel Smith's lap, and Pine is just in the background looking extremely furious. It's an incredible picture.
Yes, and if you don't know who Ethel Smith, I've for some reason I have the name is Ethel Smythe.
I might be wrong on that because my pronunciation can be.
But she wrote "March of the Women," which is like the theme song to the suffragette movement, if you will. And if you have seen Shoulder to Shoulder, which is the best miniseries from 1970 something, which is really hard to watch, but the theme song of that is the Ethel Smythe "March of the Women." And I don't know that much about her, and I haven't read her autobiography. I'll definitely check it out. Thank you for the tip.
You should. I think you would really, really enjoy it. She's, I mean, a bunch of my favorite resources, some of which actually didn't even make it to the exhibit, were from her book. She's just incredible.
So I want to pull us back to thinking about objects and this exhibit, this medal, and just come at it from like a wide scope philosophical angle. I'm curious, like, what it is like in your, from where you're sitting, what is it about like symbolic objects as opposed to just ideas that just brings additional emotional force to a story?
Yeah. Well, I think that's at the heart of why museums are just so incredible, is because I think to see an object, let alone hold it, like I was able to hold Pine's medal, it was just incredible. It just allows you to connect with this story and history that you know has happened, but it's just when there is something physical that you can hold and look at and know that this object was there, this was a part of it, it was held by this and that person is, I guess it just makes it feel more real. Like it registers as more than a story. It registers as, you know, as it was a fact, part of history.
Yeah, just to follow up on, yeah, sure. To follow up on your answer to Randy's question about why, like, why is it that objects have this power, this emotional power? And I want to go back to what you said about Leslie Graham and his collection. And you said that it reminded you, you know, of Pine's metal, because it was like he was aware of the historical significance of his decisions and his property and so forth. And I think also, you know, there's like this power of intentionality. Like for me, Pine's metal and that decision to be just thinking about the future so much and thinking about future generations and when we are not here. And like that, the act and the decision is almost like encoded into the object. And I think that like adds another layer of emotional power. Because, you know, there are many objects that come into the collection that don't have that provenance where the person's like, okay, I know I'm going to die. I'm going to leave it for historical purposes. And they still have historic power. But my point is, like, when you have someone doing that, that adds a layer to it.
Yes, that's so true.
Yeah, I think that what you've described is a really cool structure.
Yeah, no, you're so right. There is something when you know that a person was thinking about their own death and how what they want to be, I guess, remembered for, what they want to ensure that lives on after them, their achievements, and if it has any significance, you know, for wider history, it definitely adds an aspect to it that's really moving. You're absolutely right, yeah.
I'm just curious, like, as you've been exposed to this story for, you know, a better part of the last year, it's been in your mind space, when you start to look forward, what would you hope to happen with Catherine's Pine's legacy, the metal, the exhibit, and how, you know, it's going to wind down these panels, like, what would you imagine best case scenario looking like with sharing this story in a different way? Or in a bigger way? What does that look like?
That's very interesting. I personally just don't want this story to wind down ever. If anything, I just want it, you know, to transform, you know, if not me, someone else, to do deeper research into her, compile something even more comprehensive, because I believe that, you know, Hope's work, what, and both Hope's and Elizabeth Crawford's work into securing the medal to enable Pine's wishes to be fulfilled, for us to use it as, you know, I guess, educational and inspirational object. I do think that there is still work to be done. You know, I think this exhibition has brought Pine a bit more into the public knowledge, but I think she's just so fascinating, and she is such an incredibly important person that I do think her story deserves to be told, you know, again and again and again. So I really hope to see this exhibit and the medal itself to, I guess, go on to even bigger and better things. I just hope that we can get more people to be familiarized with Pine.
Well, thank you. I really feel the same way, and it's awesome. Great. To hear that coming from a person who could put the exhibits together like that.
No, I do. I really feel quite passionate about it, because for, like I said at the beginning, for me, since the internship has ended now, so it does feel like I'm so physically removed from it. It feels like it's a lot more in the past for me, but It was quite a long time working on it and just being so engrossed in Pine's story and the medal itself that it just makes me sad to think that, you know, I think she still deserves so much more respect and just publicity, I guess.
I think we're coming close to a wrap-up phase here. Was there any other questions before we do final thoughts, Hope or Riley?
I have no further questions.
I do not. I'm just taking it all in.
All right. Well, in that case, let's go around and just sort of share one summarizing thing from either this conversation or this story. I'll go first and just get us started, and then we'll have Riley go next. So my main takeaway has to do with like how hard it is to just build anything. And it's a follow-up on our, like, the fact that there's a concentrated effort to push a story into the future through this metal and through this object and all the conscious attention that went into it. Because, like, it's not just that they made something. There was a metal made, and it's not just any metal. It's a metal with a story, and it's not just any story. It's a story about, like, the largest project that humanity has ever undertaken related to, like, political enfranchisement of women. And so, like, the fact that all of that is nested together in a physical item, and there are many such physical items, but this one has a special story. My takeaway is the effort that goes into the building of a thing and how it's like, it really pays off, because here we are appreciating this, you know, so much later. So that's my takeaway.
Mine, I'd say, so with the Corrado Brazzo Foundation, we talk a lot about moral exemplars or morally energetic people, and Catherine Pine is certainly one of those people. And after being at the museum, seeing this exhibit, and all the conversations had about her before we went to visit, and now having this conversation here with Hedvig, hearing about her process, it's just, the phrase morally energetic individual is just so perfect, because there's just this magical energy that's coming from this that I need to go do more research now, and I really hope that everyone seeing that exhibit and everyone hearing this feels the same way. And that's all I've got.
Cool. I'll go. So somewhere it may be on the website nursepinemetal.com, but and Hedvig, you mentioned the British Journal of Nursing, and when per Nurse Pine, again, the episode from April 21st, 2024 is where you want the deeper backstory about the medal. But when she died, she bequeathed this to something called the History Section, an archive of the British College of Nurses. And when they receive it, they have a journal, and they write an article that's titled "A Worldwide Gift to Women." And that's very significant because, you know, there's one way to approach this story, which is this is, you know, nursing history, and this just has to do with, like, the suffragette movement. But the fact that the title of this article of October 1941 is "A Worldwide Gift to Women," and I just think it's very significant that Hedvig, you from Hungary, and myself from the United States, came together on International Women's Day, and then there are people from other countries that were there. And this is the what Riley is talking about, like this moral energy. This is something that doesn't really know boundaries when it's in a person. And I'm struck by that, and the education that this moment it has on everybody. And you know, the medal is something that, you know, came into my life because I made the decision to reproduce the hunger strike medals. There's a panel, you know, in the exhibit on the hunger strikes and the Cat and Mouse Act and the hunger strike medal. And I did that because, like you're saying, Hedvig, some of these stories, it's sad that they're not known. And most people in the United States, A, do not know the story of the U.S. movement, and B, definitely do not know the story of the British movement, and C, have never heard the name Pankhurst, and D, have never heard the name of Nurse Catherine Pyne. So these medals were made because, you know, having a visible thing is more impactful on the conscience, if you will. And so, yeah, there's so much work to be done. And the other thing is, you know, this story also is very much intersecting with peace history, with World War I, and it's just what I call a meaty morsel. So, yeah, the bumper sticker to put a bow on it is just how this is a story that's not just about a British nurse during the British suffrage movement. And yeah, that's all I have to say. And Hedvig, you have the last word.
I'm in a very difficult position because all of these were very touching. I'm not quite good with speaking concisely, as you might have noticed, but I think for me, the main takeaway is just how, and it might be an emotional takeaway, but it's really just how important it is, you know, to have people who have this strong empathy. I guess it really is what you're talking about, this moral guidance, to have for Pyne to have the empathy, you know, to be involved in this movement, to be a nurse and then fight for women's rights, and then, you know, for us many, many, many years later to still have this empathy to see this woman who was just such an interesting figure and do so much work for future generations, really. And it's, I think, everyone involved in this project, both with your foundation and, you know, at the museum, it's just it was really possible because all of these people just have this deep sense of empathy and care about making sure that this story doesn't get lost and that we can appreciate it and, you know, respect her as well.
Well said.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was great. I appreciate you being here with us, Hedvig, and obviously Hope for kind of organizing everything and getting us together here. I think that's perfect.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lovely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Hedvig. It was wonderful to talk to you again.
Yes, I know. It's been so long. I hope I can see you guys in person at some point again.
Absolutely. And good luck with your new job tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. You've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Thank you very much.
Bye.
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 Bye.